This is the state of things from the American Tobacco Broadcast. We're broadcasting for the American Tobacco Historic District. I've been here, what, 10 years? And I don't know where I'm broadcasting from. That happens now and then. I am Frank Stacio, that I know. And I also know that not everybody's a reader. But just about everybody has heard of Moby Dick, the great white whale, the novel by the literary great Herman Melville. And even if you don't read, you've probably heard of James Fenimore Cooper. You probably saw the movie based on his novel, The Last of the Mohicans. There are some of the common writers. These are writers who we commonly think of as giants of the 19th century. But why do we remember their names and not others? They certainly weren't the only writers of the 19th century, not necessarily the most popular either. But they are considered masters, while their contemporaries languish in our 21st century imaginations. Philip Gurrow might be able to shed some light on why that's the case. His new book is called Truth's Ragged Edge, The Rise of the American Novel. In it, he takes a look at some of the lesser-known works of the 19th century and the authors that made them. Philip Gurrow is a professor of American literature and culture at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and he joins us now. Welcome, Philip. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. Always a pleasure.
So what possessed you to write this book, Little Known Authors of the 19th Century?
Well, a lot of scouting in libraries to begin with, and then the realization that a lot more books had been published than we imagine. For example, if you ask any educated person how many novelists he can name before, let's say, 1860, two or three names might come to mind. Before 1860, there actually were about 3,000 different novels published in the United States, of which we read maybe 5 or 6 or 8 or 10. If you're a specialist, maybe 20 or so. So I decided to investigate first by getting a complete bibliography, a listing of these publications, and then began to investigate the popularity of them, and then to try to put together some kind of coherent story about what it means to read these and shed light on the period in a different way.
An amazing period, because this is the time when the novel is really coming of age, as is the United States of America. So it's a kind of a fascinating period to look at both the literary and political trajectory of
the canon of books that we know. You mentioned Cooper, Melville. We can add Hawthorne, Twain, Henry James. This was actually set in the early 20th century, mainly by professors like myself in the academy. They were looking for works in a sense that spoke to them at that moment in the modernist era, and they liked the kinds of things they found in Melville or Hawthorne. But if you were reading back in the 1840s or 50s, you actually would have had a much wider range of novels available, novels that very often were by women, some by African Americans, and by a whole host of male authors who now have been forgotten, but whose works really can now be read thanks to the internet and Google and Google Books and such things. I've been able to teach, actually, from these kinds of online publications, books that before were available only in rare books libraries.
And what you point out is that this was a time when novels were expected to be the stuff of social controversy. They were expected to be polemics, in a way, novelized, fictionalized.
Yeah, these were not aesthetic experiments, and I think that's another thing that the modernist critics did. They were looking for books, in a sense, that satisfied their sense of intricacy, that satisfied their sense of some kind of created object that spoke to them in the 20th century. But for readers in the 19th century, this was exactly, as you say, as another contribution, really, to civic discourse. I think we've lost that now. Novels tend to be something we do in our spare time. But when people were writing and publishing in the 1840s and 50s, these were attempts, in a sense, to speak to certain kinds of problems, certain kinds of situations in the country. That line of writers you mentioned often is taught or has been taught as a kind of trajectory of the man fronting the wild spaces of the American West. You think of Cooper, you think of Melville on the sea, you think of Huck Finn lighting out for the territories. And we've been led to believe that that's one of the main tropes of early American fiction. But there were many, many more books that were concerned, for example, with the rise of the new urban environment. I think one of the things I do in the book is to illustrate how commonly this new place, the city, with its anonymity, with its strangeness, with its horrors behind walls, really became a central player in how people understood their environment, and thus a player in the way that novels were constructed.
A lot of themes show up again: the new urban environment, slavery, women's rights, all of these things that people are talking about. These are the water cooler conversations of the 19th century. But there's an overarching theme that you talk about. that seems to be the heartbeat, the throb behind all of it. And that's this controversy, this debate, a conversation about the relationship between civic duty and individualism.
Yeah, when you read a great number of books and you try to find a narrative thrust with which to work, you're looking for things that really unite things in a very deep way. And I discovered that by the 1850s, there persisted this notion that perhaps we're stressing the individual too much. Perhaps we're digging into consciousness too much, and we have to think about people's social dimensions. So really, I see it as a conflict between what I call liberal individualism and a kind of civic duty, a kind of a sense that finally you are connected to others, and we're losing that, people were thinking in the 1850s, as people like Emerson and others pointed us toward our own self-consciousness rather than in some outer directed way. So yes, I think by the 1850s and 60s, right to the time of the Civil War, there arose this bifurcation between what we should be thinking about as we model our own personalities.
Slavery, also an important topic, of course. We know Uncle Tom's Cabin, but you talk about some lesser-known works and the way they cope with and discuss the question of slavery.
Yeah, there are some remarkable early novels by African Americans. Harriet Wilson published on the cusp of the Civil War a book called Our Nig. It's the story of a free black woman in New England who's in utter poverty, is in abject poverty, and is trying to make a living and is constantly abused, not because she's enslaved, because she's not, but in fact because of her race. Another book very similar, Frank Webb's The Garys. The Garys is set in urban Philadelphia in the 1850s. It's about middle-class black people who live in their own neighborhoods. And a part of the story involves white people who want to take over those buildings for their own development and so fabricate a kind of race riot in that period in which many of the central characters are hurt. So again, the notion that before the war slavery was the main issue really isn't the case. Already African Americans understood that it was finally racism based on color that would be the emergent problem for writers in that period and later.
And racism that expresses itself in many and varied ways, some nuanced, expressed by an African-American writer, who challenges the abolitionist because of their hypocrisy, their unwillingness to really work up north side by side with African-Americans and yet appalled at the institution of slavery.
Harriet Wilson, for example, was linked for a time. She was married to a man who presented himself as an abolitionist, evidently to get on the lecture circuit, to try to circulate and make money from that proposition. And in fact, many of the stories he told were simply fabricated. He was doing this as a kind of ploy. So Wilson is very negative about that kind of imposition on the true stories of so many other African Americans.
Which suggests that there is an industry. This fiction industry is becoming lucrative these days in the 19th century.
That's the thing that you discover as well. By the 1840s, you find really the kernel of the same industry we have today. There were coteries around certain magazines, the Knickerbocker School, as it was called in New York. The Transcendentalists in New England had their own magazine, The Dial. People knew book reviewers. They salted their reviews in certain kinds of publications, just as can be done today in some places. So you have this sense, finally, that the reputations could be constructed, particularly if you were a writer who had connections to cities like New York or Boston.
Religion, an interesting topic always in literature, particularly at this time. And because of the growth of religious splinter groups in the United States, I think it becomes even more fascinating to read the literature.
Yeah, there's a way of thinking about that as well that I present in the early parts of the narrative. In 1800, 1810, people really thought of themselves primarily as souls, as beings that had a kind of internal life that would be kept through eternity. That seems to change. By the 1820s and 30s, there's a much, much bigger emphasis on free will, on the individual being able to do things for himself, not waiting for God to be present in one's life. And I call that the period of moralism. You try to model yourself by your own efforts on a certain kind of behavior. And finally, most excitingly, by the 1860s, 50s and 60s, you move from soul to character the personality, when finally the uniqueness of each individual becomes the story, and the best fiction writers like Melville, Elizabeth Stoddard, and others focus on that interior life that makes each person special. It remains a religious matter, but the actions that flow from that belief about yourself are very, very different.
Not surprising in a nation where we find the notion of individualism now on steroids in the 19th century, that religious expression would find some common ground.
Right, exactly. And I think another thing that occurred to me as I finished the book, these debates about civic virtue and libertarianism, if I can use more current words, really are ongoing, as I just indicate by that choice. We haven't figured out yet in this country whether we should be responsible primarily to our own self-interest or to the larger public when we're debating, you know, how much Social Security should be raised for people, minimum wage, all these things, or how do I protect free enterprise? How do I protect a small businessman? These are parts of the same debate that really has been going on since the 1830s. So these novels really are excavations into the history of what we're still dealing with.
The book is Truth's Ragged Edge, The Rise of the American Novel. Philip Gura is my guest. We're talking about these novels in the 19th century. They were very popular at the time, too. So it's not as though these were obscure authors. This was the stuff of...
Yeah, one of the more interesting is by a man named Ick Marvell. The book was called Reveries of a Bachelor. It was popular throughout the 19th century and published really into the early 20th century, and you wonder why. Well, it begins to make sense when you realize that his work was published around the same time as Melville and others were beginning to probe personality on their own. Ick Marvell sits before a fireside for most of the book and dreams. Essentially goes into a kind of stream of consciousness about his desires, about what it would be like to be married, what would it be like to have a child, what would happen if I lost my family. It never happens. It always is occurring simply internally in his consciousness. And for some reason, this book about the dream life of a bachelor became one of the bestsellers of that period and then, of course, simply dropped after the early 20th century. Harry Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin. It has an afterlife on the minstrel stage. Certain troops actually perform scenes from Uncle Tom's Cabin, but as a work of literature that express very profound things about the bifurcated nation at that time, it drops off the chart until the 1960s and 70s and the Black Studies movement.
And you're pointing to something very interesting because the novel changes in kind over this time from this objective cinematic view of things, life in the city, to a much more subjective kind of stream of consciousness. All of that is taking place over this 19th century.
Actually, those are things that are happening simultaneously, I think. That's what's most exciting. You find people who are investigating that self-consciousness in very new ways, in very profound ways, and you find other voices. Those saying, you know, if you're looking at yourself too much, you're not going to be looking at other people. And I find in these 1860s and early 70s, in particular, books that finally began to point out that social responsibility is part of our uniqueness as individuals as well, and we have to cultivate it.
You talk about some interesting figures in the book, too. We talked about African-American writers, women as well. Elizabeth Stoddard and Mary Gove Nichols are two that I found interesting.
Mary Gove Nichols was a fascinating sort. Her book, Mary Lyndon, is another one of these forgotten novels. After a very horrible marriage to an abusive husband, she decided simply to leave him and take her child without divorce, which was a very, very rare move at that point in time. And he would not divorce her from spite. So she had to make her way as a single parent. She made her way by giving lectures on women's anatomy, by giving lectures on hydropathy, that is the kind of curing of illness by the water cure, as it was called. Finally found her way into advanced socialist circles. There was a movement following the ideas of a man named Charles Fourier, a French socialist. Brook Farm, the transcendentalist commune, was enthralled to his ideas for a time. She found herself into that circle and ended up in a free love community on Long Island called Modern Times, where she lived in an open marriage with an individual for a number of years. And in her novel, Mary Lyndon, Mary Gove Nichols actually has the heroine have a child with her lover, but never be married because both people want to keep their individual responsibility. This is a person at least as radical as someone like Margaret Fuller, who is considered a real one of the pillars of the early feminist movement. Mary Gove Nichols should be right there with her in this remarkable novel.
We said that these novels were popular, but take somebody like Mary Gove Nichols. Do we know who was reading her book? Was it most?
Well, one of the ways I tried to get at the list of books on which I focused was through reading a certain set of periodicals, reading the important media of that time. For example, Horace Greeley's New York Tribune every week had several books reviewed. These coteries of literary figures I mentioned usually had monthly or quarterly magazines. So people who were noticed and who had extended discussion in these kinds of places were the ones on whom I spent the most time. And indeed, someone like Nichols indeed was reviewed in these kinds of publications. So you get a sense that at least in the larger urban areas, these books are circulating. Something like Uncle Tom's Cabin circulating, we know, throughout the country.
Philip, you are an expert in this period and in literature, particularly American literature. You wrote a wonderful book on the Transcendentalists, the most well-known writers of the time. Now you're looking at those who have become obscure, but certainly were well-known in their time. Were there surprises for you?
Oh, I think so, very much. I think this whole question of the new environment of the city remains to be explored more fully. For example, one way we think about this period is through the phrase of the cult of domesticity, how the home and the mother were central to people's moral development. When you have scores of people living now in this new place called a boarding house or in what we now call apartments, when you talk about people living away from family, not having the kind of support system they had, you're building a whole new kind of character. And some of these novels actually begin to explore what happens in that really anonymous environment that was not seen before this time. So, yeah, there were surprises in the sense that the picture of what one could be reading was much more complex than I had ever imagined.
I think you talked a little bit about this earlier in this conversation, what makes a novel enduring, how they endure, and why others drop off the map. But amplify that for us.
Well, it's again, I think it's a function of the academy. That is, the books I teach in a survey become the books that the person who becomes a teacher in that class will teach in his or her survey unless she makes an exploration of the kind that I did. So we're not going to make these books popular to the general public without, I think, somehow broadcasting them, I hope, through books like mine that make this apparent. But if you're interested, not in an aesthetic object, but in a kind of a novel as a function of its time and a way of exploring new ways of understanding its characters, one can go back to these with a great, great degree of pleasure.
The title of this book, Truth's Ragged Edge, comes from the title of a Melville Melville's book, Billy Budd. You took it from that.
He mentions there, he says, truth uncompromisingly told will always have its ragged edges. And he means that if you try to get at the real truth, it's going to look messy, it's going to look torn, it's going to look somehow not quite finished. And that's how I view many of these novels. They're not literary masterpieces in the sense of a book by Hemingway or perhaps a book by Faulkner or Henry James. And yet the very fact that the author tried to get at these different kinds of truths is what makes them so exciting to us.
And that somehow they resonated with the people of that time.
Right. And I hope with our own time.
Yeah. So we may learn much more if we go back to these books. Philip, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank.
Philip Gurrow, Professor of American Literature and Culture at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Just ahead, writer Joe McHugh tackles storytelling and how it influences the way we think. Stay tuned.